Hi, thanks for joining us this morning. I'm Chrissy Mernon, and my guest is Dr. James Prieto. He is a colorectal surgeon with the Baptist Health System. And we're going to talk about something people don't like to talk about, colorectal cancer. And really, we should be talking about it because it is considered the second deadliest form of cancer. I have a list from website Lung and Bronchial Cancers, number one, colon and rectal cancer, number two, breast cancer, number three, pancreatic cancer, number four, and prostate cancer, number five, as far as the deadliest cancers. And according to the National Cancer Institute, in 2017, an estimated 50,000 people died from colorectal cancer. The American Cancer Society estimates that more than 97,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer this year. Right now, in the United States, more than 1.3 million people are living with the disease. It is the fourth most common cancer after breast, lung, and prostate cancer. But again, those earlier things were about the deadliest cancers. And so it's always in the top five.
Correct.
Before we started today, I said, okay, so you're a colorectal surgeon. Were you a gastroenterologist first?
No, there's a little bit of confusion about the difference between a gastroenterologist and a colorectal surgeon. A gastroenterologist is a physician who has completed medical school, gone through internal medicine residency or training, and done additional fellowship training to learn medical and endoscopic management of the gut. A colorectal surgeon has finished medical school, gone through general surgery residency, learned to be a general surgeon, and done additional training and fellowship training to learn to treat diseases of the colon, rectum, and anus. The reason there's some confusion is that, to an extent, both physicians do colonoscopy. I work extensively with my gastroenterology colleagues and among other colorectal surgeons. There is some overlap, but generally the gastroenterologists treat medically diseases of the gut, stomach, small intestine, colon. They also do a significant proportion of their practice with endoscopy, so upper endoscopy, lower endoscopy. Colorectal surgeons are surgeons who do surgery for diseases of the colon, rectum, and anus. And they use colonoscopy as an adjunct to better treat patients. Mm-hmm. Not every patient that comes to see the colorectal surgeon comes in for surgery. So we do a fair amount of medical treatment of various diseases, including anorectal disease, so hemorrhoids, fissures, constipation, incontinence. We also help, as part of the team, treating various diseases, including inflammatory bowel disease, like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and of course, any cancers and diverticulitis. That's a large proportion of our practice, including mm-hmm. surgical management.
So why did you choose this field? So you went to medical school to become a doctor and then a surgeon. Did you always want to be a surgeon? How'd you wind up as a doctor?
My father was a physician. He was an OBGYN, and I was exposed to it at a young age, and I saw the lifestyle. I actually considered engineering at that time and decided on doing medicine because it's a people practice. I enjoy being around people. Mm-hmm. So I went into medical school. I was fortunate to enroll in the honors program at Miami at the time, which was a combined program. And so I went all the way through from college and medical school. And I kept an open mind during medical school. Thought that I haven't been exposed to all these other fields, see if I really liked it. But I always got drawn back towards surgery. And so I went through general surgery because to me it was the best approach to have versatility in deciding if there were other fields I wanted to go into in the various subspecialties of general surgery. And eventually, I ended up falling in love with colorectal because every time we ended up doing a deep pelvic cancer surgery, we found immense satisfaction. There were challenging surgeries. Generally, the patients do well. We found that patients were very satisfied. And so it actually, believe it or not, it's one of the most competitive fields in general surgery right now.
Really?
Yeah, it is.
How about that? So we're going to talk about colorectal cancer, and March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, but really every month we should have an awareness about it. Who's at risk for colorectal cancer? And I'm sure there's some concern about younger people because they don't even think about it.
Correct. That is one of the biggest problems now, is that we're seeing a rapid rise in younger people with colorectal cancer. Of course, over age 50, your risk is higher. There are various other risk factors, including obesity, tobacco use, alcohol use, dietary risk factors, including consumption of various foods, which are carcinogens, sedentary lifestyle, family history is also a big one that's missed by a lot of people. If you have a significant family history of related cancers, such as stomach, colon, pancreatic, uterine, brain, these various other cancers increase your personal risk of developing cancer for yourself if you have a family history.
Dr. Prieto, everything you mentioned until the family history, I thought, you know, we have some control over some of those risk factors.
That's correct. The big one also being diet. A lot of the various foods are carcinogenic in nature or cancer-causing. And of course, it is dose-dependent, but the big ones being alcohol, tobacco, bloody meats, charred, cyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are the other food, like so burnt ends, sodium nitrate, which is your hot dogs and bacon. These are the big ones that are known to cause cancer.
So what do you eat? I'm thinking you have all this information and you know what? I think all of us, nobody wants cancer. We all want to avoid cancer. And
yeah.
So what do you do? Because you have, you know, this knowledge, you see it all every day.
Well, so what I've gone towards a more plant-based diet, and I'll say honestly, 5 days during the week, I'm very good about it, and the weekend we'll fall off the wagon a little bit because you got to enjoy life. Who doesn't like a steak if you live in Texas?
Right, right.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, you have to eat, and there's so many things out there. So in moderation? Or
in moderation,
occasionally
yeah.
Things are okay?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's a dose-dependent thing. And so, you know, if you're eating super healthy, are you actually living longer, or does it only seem like it? You know,
don't go overboard on your Okay, how do you lower your risk? Okay, we talk about look at what you're eating. You talked about processed foods.
Right, processed foods also. Well, processed foods in general, we're finding are pretty harmful with their high sugar content, preservatives. We're finding that plant-based, more natural foods are generally healthier.
So you almost become vegetarian? With the exception of your occasional steak.
Yeah, for my personal diet, I've gone towards a more plant-based. So for me personally, it's about 80% plants, vegetables primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that the first couple weeks were brutal in transitioning away from the American diet. But after that couple weeks, almost like getting off tobacco, or you get used to it, actually like it better. Mm-hmm.
But when you look around at our society, when you walk into a convenience store or even a grocery store, or you go to a restaurant with friends, what do you see?
Well, I see a lot of preserved foods, high sugar, high fat content, a lot of fried. You know, that's where the flavor is. A lot of butter when you go out to eat in restaurants, that's where the flavor is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've found places to go out to eat and been very careful, but it is very difficult. So generally we eat more at home.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was gonna say, you see that it's bad for people, but good for your business, huh? You know?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, you know, we see a lot of diseases related to the Tex-Mex diet. It's almost like if I have a patient come in who hasn't had her gallbladder taken out, then I'm like, well, you're not really from San Antonio. So
really, I mean, that's because of the way we've eaten over the course of our lives?
Yeah, I think also our culture and our diet with a lot of lard and flour and high carbohydrates, high fat, that's played a role.
Mm-hmm.
We see a lot of gallbladder disease, a lot of hemorrhoids from not eating enough fiber. We end up seeing a lot of diverticulitis from people not eating enough fiber. And then if they're unfortunate enough later on, they develop cancer. And of course, the heart disease, eventually the kidney disease, and it progresses downhill from there.
So colorectal cancer, how is it detected? And, you know, we hear the message at 50,
right?
Happy birthday, get a colonoscopy.
50 is a number established as for an average risk individual who has no symptoms whatsoever. That's important for people to keep in mind that's if you have a strong family history of cancer, if you have symptoms, change in your bowel habits, change in your stool characteristics. They're getting thin like pencils. They're getting loose. You're having a hard time evacuating. You're having blood. You have unexplained weight loss. These are things that put you in a separate category. Those are signs that you need to seek medical attention urgently to make sure that this is addressed adequately. The way to check for colorectal cancer, the gold standard, is to do a colonoscopy. However, there are other tests that are available that are non-invasive. One of them being a fecal DNA test called a Cologuard, recently gained FDA approval. It is something that we use in our practice, but it is made for individuals who are asymptomatic without a family history. Mm-hmm. It's basically a stool DNA test. You put some stool in a box and send it off to the lab, and they check for the DNA of cancer. It's a great test. It's not as accurate as colonoscopy, but for the people who don't want to go through the invasiveness of a colonoscopy, even though it's very well tolerated, that is an excellent, acceptable alternative.
You know, and it sounds so much cheaper, because if you have a colonoscopy, you have to do the prep, and you know, I think the preparation, the stuff that makes you get your innards clean,
right,
is kind of pricey. It didn't used to be, but something about it affects your kidneys.
Well, you bring up a lot of good points in that. So let's talk about the cost of a colonoscopy versus a fecal DNA test. So the fecal DNA test is about $600. It generally, many insurances will pay, not all. The total cost to an insurer for a colonoscopy is anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000, depending on your market. So here it's generally $1,000 to $1,200. The benefit of the colonoscopy is the only test that's both diagnostic and therapeutic, which means if we find a problem, then we can remove it right then and there many times with the camera itself. Versus with the stool DNA test, if we find a problem, then you have to do the colonoscopy. The cost for the prep generally is covered by insurance. There's a multitude of different preps on the market. There was a lot of press about a decade ago about the Fleet's phosphate sodas and the other preps that were known to cause kidney damage. Those have been taken off the market. Some of the preps that we use for patients with kidney issues are not the best tasting things, although we counsel patients on how to take them so they don't have that bad taste, generally a big straw and a lot of ice. but there are newer formulations on the market, which are really great, and I use them for most of my patients who are really scared from talking to other friends and family who said, I drank this horrible thing and it was gross and I threw it up. We use a small volume prep that tastes like 5 ounces of Sprite, 2 bottles of those, one the evening before the colonoscopy, one the morning of. You do a liquid diet the day before the procedure. It's really not that bad. Mm-hmm. In terms of cost, generally, if you're going to pay out of pocket for that sort of prep, it's somewhere around $130, $150, but generally insurances will pay it. If we have patients come in for that, we generally will try and help them out, as would probably most or all physicians in the San Antonio market. If we see a patient is financially strapped, we'll do whatever we can to help them. Mm-hmm. And of course, we do have some various other formulations that are less expensive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we were talking about at 50. So at 50, generally, that's it. You said if you didn't have these other factors going on, what about younger people? Because the information that the Baptist Health System sent me was that, unfortunately, younger people, studies by the American Cancer Society found that although colon cancer rates declined for those over 50, they have risen by 1 to 2% per year for those ages 20 to 39. And you know, does a 20-year-old expect to get colon cancer?
No, but it's something that when we see is usually pretty horrible. We see someone on the uprise, usually they have 1 or 2 children, they're starting their career, they've had a couple years of bleeding that they attributed to hemorrhoids. You know, no one really thinks, well, you know, a 20-year-old has a colon cancer, and generally they've used about 6 months of hemorrhoidal creams and tried fiber supplementation to the point before they actually come to my office. Mm-hmm. And at that point, either they're referred to me through a gastroenterologist who's done their colonoscopy and found a cancer, or they've come to me for a hemorrhoid and I've done a more extensive workup. And it's something that we do see, mm-hmm. and it's rather unfortunate. They tend to be more aggressive cancers. Many times we can tease out those individuals with a family history, though. And this is why it's so important that you're keen to your family history. If you have any related cancers, seek the care of your medical doctor or even a genetics counselor, if necessary, if you have that much cancer.
So you mentioned colon cancer, but then you mentioned other cancers as well.
Correct. There are associated cancers that increase your personal risk of having colon cancer, whether or not it's uterine, endometrial, ovarian, stomach, small intestine, brain. The other one, which people don't realize, is breast. breast cancer and colon cancer are related. There's a strong risk of developing one or the other. If you have colon, you can develop breast cancer. If you have breast cancer, you can develop colon cancer.
Mm-hmm. So really, you need to talk to your relatives about what's in the family.
Correct.
So why do people delay coming to you? Because of the nature of what's going on? You know, we're kind of embarrassed about stuff, or we don't think it's as, you know, bad. Or some people think, oh, it's cancer right away.
Well, the stigma is that diseases of the colon, rectum, and anus are something that are kind of gross or shouldn't be talked about or joked about. And this is a very private part of your body, which you don't even speak to your spouse or children about. And then you have to go meet some stranger that you have to tell your inner darkest secrets about how you go to the bathroom. It takes a fair amount of muster to do that. And we are understanding of that. And in our practice, we make sure that patients feel comfortable and are in a relaxed environment. Most people who come to our office are pretty scared.
Mm-hmm.
And we take a lot of time to discuss why we're doing what we're doing, that we're here to help, that we're not here to torture people. You know, that's a big part of it. Historically, I think 30, 40 years ago, physicians did not have that understanding that this part of the body needs to be dealt with very sensitively. You know, mm-hmm. colonoscopies in the past were either given with no sedation in the beginnings or with mild sedation. The preps really didn't taste great, and a lot of people really didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've evolved in the practice of treating the gut and are mindful that patients really don't want to be awake for this stuff. They don't want to drink these horrible things the day prior, and we're very sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when patients come to our office, we really try and make sure that we give a comfortable, relaxing environment. We're not there to hurt them, and I think that people understand that,
mm-hmm.
and they come to us for help.
So where does colon cancer come from?
Colon cancer in general, most of them come from a mutation along the inner lining. Over time, various insults to the inner lining of the gut can cause mutations along the inner glands of the lining of the intestine, which over time can cause abnormalities. Generally, they begin as polyps, which are little tiny projections or growths along the inner lining of the intestine. Not every polyp will turn into a cancer, but if there's enough time sequence for it to get more and more mutated, it will turn into a cancer. As a polyp grows, the risk of becoming a cancer increases. So as the polyp goes to 1 centimeter in size, the risk of cancer goes to 20%, and the bigger it gets, the higher the risk of cancer development.
Mm-hmm.
About 1 in 1,000 polyps will eventually become a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so generally when a colonoscopy is done, these polyps are generally removed. They're inspected under a microscope by a pathologist to assess and see what the risk is. There's a wide variety of different methods of mutation that cause different types of polyps with different cellular architecture that we see under a microscope. And that helps us to convey risk. And we decide for recommendations for patients on when to do a follow-up colonoscopy. Because once you remove all those polyps, you're good for that time period, but you have the risk of developing more polyps in the future.
So when you remove polyps, do they come back at the same spot, you know, because your body developed one there, or because you're just developing polyps that you're just going to produce some more?
Sometimes. So when I see a fairly large polyp that was removed, many times it has already been actually inked during the colonoscopy. We'll actually put a little tattoo there. And so that if it does come back at a spot where there was a large polyp removed, we can keep a close eye on that.
Oh, so you put a mark. It's like, watch this one, huh?
Exactly.
And so the next person going scoping sees it and says, oh, this
That's
is an
correct.
Issue. Okay.
It, we also do a lot of marking too, because if there is a large polyp that is removed by the gastroenterologist and it turns out there's a cancer in there, then that would require surgery. And if we're doing a laparoscopic surgery, it's virtually impossible to find that spot,
mm-hmm.
because it's not even a growth. So that tattoo spot ensures that we do right site surgery.
Good to know. Our guest this morning, Dr. James Prieto. He is a colorectal surgeon with the Baptist Health System. And we're talking about colorectal cancer, who should be aware of it. And then once you get the diagnosis, so how is colon cancer diagnosed? Through a colonoscopy?
Generally, yes.
Any other ways, or are you have to go in and determine what's there?
Yeah, most of the time it's found through colonoscopy with a biopsy that's inspected by a pathologist under microscope that confirms the presence of cancer. once that diagnosis of cancer is made, then we do a workup to see if, God forbid, the cancer has spread. Many times we get our oncology colleagues involved. These are medical doctors who dose and give appropriate various types of chemotherapy treatments, and even sometimes a radiation oncologist who are physicians who dose and give proper amounts of radiation therapy for example, rectal or anal cancer. Certain cancers are treated with chemotherapy first. Certain cancers are treated with chemotherapy and radiation first. Other cancers require surgery first, or a multitude of various different methods. And many times that also requires a multidisciplinary team approach to treat these, including input from the surgeon, the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, and the various other medical specialties if there are other various other medical problems.
So you're really getting a fleet of doctors when you get a diagnosis of colon cancer.
Exactly.
Or the other cancers. And so I imagine when you tell people you have cancer, the world just comes to a sudden stop for them.
It's a pretty horrible time and not a very pleasant part of my office visit. I generally will spend a lot of time with people where they come into my office with a new diagnosis of a colorectal cancer. This is a devastating, life-defining moment. And generally, we will make sure that patients and families have a complete understanding of what's going on. Generally, my experience has been that people come to the office with this type of horrible news, generally only understand about 20 to 25% of what I tell them the first time because they're in so much shock. And many times I'll offer even a second appointment or as many appointments as needed to help it sort of sink in and gain an understanding of what's going on, because an engaged patient does better.
Mm-hmm. And as you're saying that, I'm thinking, shouldn't someone go with you to these appointments, you know, that somebody who can really kind of say, well, I heard the doctor say this or they said that's helpful?
Yeah, generally, there were studies done that actually showed that your outcomes for cancer will do better if you have strong family and social support. Now, for the people who live by themselves, don't let that deter you, of course. And your physicians will play a key role in being your social support, too, in helping you to do as well as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said in some cases you do chemotherapy, some cases chemotherapy and radiation, and some cases straight to surgery. Why do you go straight to surgery on some?
Well, certain locations of cancers cannot be treated appropriately with radiation therapy successfully first. If it's an isolated cancer in the colon, generally surgery is done first. If there is someone who has a cancer that would otherwise be amenable to upfront chemotherapy and radiation, but they have a surgical emergency, whether or not it's a perforation or an obstruction or bleeding, those are reasons to do surgery first.
Mm-hmm. So with colon cancer, you've got to take out a section of the colon.
Correct.
What happens, because I know people, that gets into another embarrassing thing for people, is a bag.
A bag is something that generally people fear and hate the most. And it's something for a combination of reasons. Number one, who wants to deal with a bag of stool through their abdominal wall? Number two, it's something where generally people will have their grandparents who have dealt with it 20, 30 years ago, and they said it was very difficult to deal with. It's been something that they all generally hated dealing with. I spend a lot of time counseling patients that I really don't have any pleasure in giving patients a bag, a colostomy or ileostomy. And I've spent a lot of time in explaining to patients that these are not done to punish them. These are meant to be life-saving procedures. They're good indications and reasons for someone having a bag. Not everyone requires a bag. When someone has a bag, they need to also understand that we have excellent support systems in place. There are wound ostomy continence nurses. There are nurses that are certified and specialized in treating care for the bag and the ostomy. There are over 300 different appliances on the market made for physical activity, swimming, sexual activity. You know, there's lots of different options for people who have a bag. And generally, we let patients know that placing the bag is something, and many times can be temporary, and it's also a lot of patient factors. You know, and one of the biggest factors that patients don't understand is that if they can't hold their stool before they have the cancer, and we're going to take out a piece of colon, then why would we reconnect it and then they're messing their pants more?
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather go into a bag than mess your pants. And that's one of the big reasons for it. Mm-hmm. Other reasons are technical factors. If it's just not possible for the connection to succeed, we have that discussion too, and there's various reasons for that.
Mm-hmm. So for some people, just taking out a section of the colon is enough as far as treatment, and there's nothing else that needs to be done?
Well, it depends on the stage of the cancer.
Okay.
So more aggressive cancers that have mutated to the point where the cancer has learned to spread outside the wall of the intestine towards the lymph nodes or towards adjacent organs or distant organs, those are individuals who would likely require chemotherapy to help destroy a microscopic disease or visible disease in other sites. We've had a quiet revolution in treatments with advances in chemotherapy and radiation for treating cancers of the colon and rectum and anus, actually as much, if not more so, than advances in breast cancer. It's just that no one really wants to talk about.
Well, go ahead. So what's happened?
Well, so in the past 30 years, we've had the addition of chemotherapy and radiation for upfront treatment of rectal cancers, which has resulted in more successful surgeries with removal of all of the cancers in the pelvis. Deep pelvic surgery is a very difficult surgery because the rectum is surrounded by the bony pelvis, which makes surgery very difficult. And if the cancer is spread into the bone, you generally want to do a surgery that you can remove all visible cancer. So that was one of the first things. Another thing was when big studies were done in the 80s about treating anal cancer. Prior to that, we would remove the anus and rectum and give a permanent colostomy. And since the addition of Nigro protocol, which is it's a combination of therapy that was determined to have excellent cure rates for anal cancer. We rarely do major expertive surgery to remove the rectum and anus.
Mm-hmm.
Other additions have been additions of stage 4 chemotherapeutic agents, which alter the tumor's ability to grow blood vessels to feed itself. These have been an excellent addition for patients with stage 4 colon cancer with median survival exceeding 20 months, whereas before it was very short time,
mm-hmm.
Talking the order of a few months.
Mm-hmm.
So even with those individuals, we have patients who come back years later with advanced cancers where we do very aggressive treatments, including combinations of surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and we can extend their lives and give them excellent high quality remaining years of their life.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's a lot of hope and you never give up.
That's correct. And we keep learning all the time. Every so many months, we learn about more mutations. We're in the process of developing better treatments. There's continued evolution in the treatment of cancers of the colon, rectum, and anus.
So before we let you get away, Dr. James Prieto, he's a colorectal surgeon with the Baptist Health System. What advice do you have for people?
Best advice I can say, number one, is let food be thy medicine. Be mindful of what you're eating. It's okay to fall off the wagon and eat great tasting foods, but it's also very important to consider a plant-based diet. Number two, listen to your body. If you have a change in what normally works for you, if you're normally constipated, you develop diarrhea. You have diarrhea, you develop constipation. Your stools aren't normal. You're noticing a change in weight. You're more tired. You see some blood. These are not things to ignore. These are things to seek appropriate medical advice. If necessary, seek the care of a gastroenterologist or colorectal surgeon. We're here to help. Generally, many diseases of the colon, rectum, and anus can be minimized if caught early. If you wait a couple years, that might make all the difference in the world for your long-term survival.
Mm-hmm. And things don't go away, do they?
Well, generally, no. If it's something as simple as a hemorrhoid, you're a young person and you've changed your diet and you feel better, well, that's something that maybe with close follow-up, we can make sure we just watch. Even then, given what we talked about earlier about the increasing rise of colon cancer in younger people, we have to be very cautious with managing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something where we really are here to help and make sure that you live a long, healthy, productive life.
So for young people especially, you say?
Correct. For young people.
Pay attention to all that, especially what you're putting in your body.
Right.
Because it does make a difference. You can't change your family history, but you should know your family history.
That's correct. And we have excellent tests out in the market for genetic testing to stratify risk. That also is very important too, because someone who has a very strong family history of cancer might actually require colonoscopy between age 20 and 25 instead of 50.
Mm-hmm.
And prevention is key for many of these cancers. If we catch it early, people will do better. We can do preventative surgeries, preventative treatments to keep you from suffering immensely.
I want to thank you so much for coming by. Our guest this morning, Dr. James Prieto, colorectal surgeon with the Baptist Health System.
Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.